Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 15 of Writers Aloud. This week, the children's writer Heather Dyer speaks with Julia Copus about the unexpected pitfalls of early career success and how she overcame creative block through a process of awakening and relinquishment.
The publishing world can be a fickle place, and in today's climate it's not unusual for a writer to go from best-selling author to a position where they have no publisher at all. How does such a writer keep faith in their work and in the practice of writing for its own sake? In this podcast, I talk to children's writer Heather Dyer about the psychology of creativity, the ups and downs of publishing, and how she kept going in her own career in the face of some fairly major setbacks. So Heather, how did you become a children's writer in the first place? I think your first book for older children was The Fish in Room 11, but I understand that you wrote another book before that. How did you come to write that very first book?
Yeah, that was a picture book, Tina and the Penguin. And I was abroad, I was in Canada. I was dabbling with writing, keeping a journal, keeping a travel diary, and had joined an amateur writers group. So it was one of the sort of pieces I took into them. And I don't really know why I wrote a children's story. It was based on a memory, an anecdote that I'd heard my dad had told me years before about something that had happened in my hometown. So I don't know if I was thinking of home or what.
That intrigues me. It was called Tina and the Penguin, and you said it was based on reality. Can you say a bit more about
that? Well, it was an article in the newspaper about a school group that had done a trip to the local zoo, and one of the boys had taken a penguin home with him on the bus. So that was what sparked the story idea. I've no idea why that came to mind. Later, actually, I was doing a few school visits in my hometown, and I was reading that book to the class.
Right.
And one of the teachers put his hand up at the back and said, that was my class. I was the one who took
How
them to
amazing.
The zoo and said, he never got the penguin home, apparently, because they turned around and took it back to the zoo before they got
home.
Oh,
right, okay. Weird. And in your story,
She takes it home, and the penguin, though, finds its way back to Antarctica.
How brilliant. I love it. So what year is this? When did Tina and the Penguin come out?
I think that was 2001, when I was in Canada, sort of finishing up a long travelling spree.
So before you went out, you had no intention of becoming a writer or any ambitions in that direction?
No, I hadn't a clue what I was going to do. I just finished a degree in biology, didn't know what to do with it, went off travelling for lack of anything else to do, and I started writing a travel journal. Travelling, I think, is what got me back into writing.
So this was something that you had been interested in?
It was.
As a young adult?
As a child.
As a
7, 8-year-old, I used to write stories at home and at school. And loved reading. That was my big pleasure, really. I don't know why I kind of veered off the English arts route and went down the science route, really.
So then I believe it was 2005 when your first book for older children, if you like, came out. And that was The Fish in Room 11. Why did you think you made that move from the picture book to writing for older children?
I think I was just exploring the stories by then more deeply and finding my own voice. And I think my voice has settled at about 8 years old. I don't know why, but I reckon there's a link between one's favourite age, especially when writing for children,
yes,
and the voice you end up with. 8 was my favourite age, I think. I loved reading then. And I started by trying to copy the authors that I'd loved, Ian Nesbitt, Enid Blyton, that kind of thing. And through doing that, found my own voice, and so was writing then for my ideal age group.
Mm. And
Now, can you say something? You're using this term, finding your own voice, for people who are unsure what that might mean, because it's something that, as writers, we use a lot, isn't it?
That's right, and it's so important because that's what makes you want to read a certain author, isn't it? Something about the voice. Mm. You can't define it, really, but it's you want to hear what they have to say in their voice.
And you've also said that you started by copying other writers, like Enid Blyton and so on. And that's the way that many, many writers start to write, isn't it? I did the same myself. I copied Sylvia Plath over and over again. And in doing that, it's part of the journey, isn't it, towards finding your own voice, I think. It's a way of practicing the trade.
I think it is. It's sort of an exploration. Mm. And perhaps you copy others, go in their footsteps and try and emulate the ones you've liked. But you can't be anyone else, really. Yes. I think that you've got your voice already. You don't have to worry about it. If you do worry about it, it'll go away. You know, you just have to be authentic and keep practicing so that you can be more authentic and stop thinking about it too much. Mm. Don't worry about being stylish or trying to be anything. And your voice will come out, just like being an authentic person.
So here we are in 2004 with The Fish in Room 11. You feel you've found your voice now. And in fact, I think that was part of a 2-book deal.
Yes, I'd written 2 books by then, The Fish in Room 11, and the second one was The Girl with the Broken Wing, both for the same age group. So I sent them both out to agents, not sending out sort of a cover letter in 3 chapters and a synopsis like is recommended.
We were advised to do that.
That's right, yeah. I'd written the whole things first. And yeah, I was really fortunate with Hilary Delamere at the agency, who took them on and placed them with Chicken House.
And so how quick was that process, roughly? Can you remember how long that took and then having the books placed?
I submitted to lots of agents, probably over maybe 3 or 4 months. And, you know, you sit at home waiting for them all to come back, mainly rejections, sometimes positive comments, so you think I'll keep sending. Yeah, and after Hilary taking them on and saying that she would try and sell them, then it wasn't long after that, I think, a matter of weeks, and she had 2 people interested and we went with the Chicken House. So that was great. It was amazing. And I was at work, actually, working for North Wales Police, administrative, so I was in the office, and I don't know if it was an email or a fax that came through, but it was them saying, you know, the deal is done and this is the offer. And so it was just amazing. I really felt like things were going to change.
So there we are, and it's all going very well. And I know that also you've won some fairly impressive awards along the way. Can you tell us a bit about those?
Well, yeah, I was really fortunate. And I had some good reviews, and The Fish in Room 11 won the Highland Book Awards in 2004, I think. And so that was fantastic, going up there, getting the award, meeting other writers, you know, that was an incredible experience. And after that, The Girl with the Broken Wing was voted for one of Richard and Judy's best children's books ever, I think the title was, with a few others. So that was incredible.
So how did it feel to you to be so generally lauded quite early on in your career?
Well, it was amazing, and it came as a big surprise, and it felt fantastic. I felt like I was on track. You know, I could do this. I could do it well. People liked it. I felt really validated, and I had no reason to think that I couldn't keep on doing it.
So it was certainly a good feeling to have the praise. But did it also, in a sense, put you under any pressure?
Well, I mean, aside from the pressure of having to do school visits, the terror of facing a classroom of children, standing up, you know, to be on the award stage, which was frightening. Yeah, there was a certain amount of pressure because suddenly now I was trying to keep that standard up and I was trying to write quickly because both the agent and the publisher impressed upon me that you need to be writing a book a year. You need to keep the momentum going. That's what they kept saying. So that there's a new book to market, your backlist will keep in sales, people won't forget about you.
So it sounds like the pressure was coming from the agent and the publisher.
Yes. So the pressure was there in that respect, but there was also the self-imposed pressure, which probably exceeded anything that anyone else could have put upon me, which was about writing the next book that would be just as good, if not better.
Yes.
You know, my own sort of personal standard of quality. When you've been winning these awards and you know, people have been saying such nice things, then how do you top that?
So when you got the commission for your third book for older children, something changed, I believe. Can you tell us about
that? Well, it did change. I didn't realise it at the time, but now, for the first time, I was writing a book to order. I knew people would be waiting for it. Mm-hmm. And I felt I knew the standard I had to achieve, but I also felt I knew more about writing as well, but found it very difficult to write the third book. Somehow it wouldn't come. Mm. I didn't know why it was so hard to do, but it took me about another 3 years to write the third book, which was The Boy in the Biscuit Tin. Lots of false starts with that.
And what had happened, do you think, in your own mind?
Well, in retrospect, I feel that I lost that beginner's mentality. The first two books I wrote without having a clue about the industry, the format, the length, the voice, anything. And I say now to new writers when I'm teaching, I say, you know, enjoy this time now before you're rich and famous. Mm-hmm. Just enjoy the fact that no one's looking over your shoulder. You've got all the time in the world. You can write whatever you want to write and just play with it, really. Mm-hmm. Not feel you have to take it too seriously. It is a valuable experience, writing, thinking that nobody might be listening, because then you don't feel self-conscious and you don't have that pressure on you.
Mm. So The Boy in the Biscuit Tin is published. And then what happened after that?
After that, I knew that I still had this second book in the two-book contract to deliver, so I knew I had to keep going and produce another one as quickly as possible again. And it was just increasingly more and more difficult. It was the ideas that I found difficult, coming up with the plot. It wasn't that I wasn't writing. It wasn't that I couldn't form decent sentences. It was the storylines that wouldn't hang together. Or maybe I was trying too hard to take the characters down a certain route. I don't know.
So do you think a writer can be too organised then, too sort of left-brained, if you like, when it comes to thinking about future work and setting off on the journey of a new book?
I do. And I think that when I wrote my first two books, I had no idea where they were going. I just started with my characters and tried to see what they would do. It did involve false starts and it did involve going down blind alleys, but I just wandered about in the story. I didn't have as much of a sense of direction, so I just explored until it came together. With subsequent books then, I knew that I had to head to an end. There's a phrase, a quote, "Don't be attached to the outcome, be open to the outcome." And all of a sudden, I was no longer open to the outcome. I was attached to the outcome. I wanted to finish and I wanted it to be good.
And do you think it's a cultural thing? Do you think that in the West, perhaps we've been taught to value left brain activity above things like intuition or...
I do. I think that's a big part of it. And I can't only blame my upbringing and my culture, because I think that's my personality too. I'm quite an organised person. I'm a bit of an overachiever. I always did well in school because I wanted to, you know, do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's conducive to creativity. But I also think that school and our culture does play a part. You know, children in schools now, when I visit schools, I find out that they're all being told to plot their stories in advance. Mm-hmm. Think of the beginning, middle and end before they begin. And that isn't the way that most writers work. Even those writers who say they plot in advance, I wonder whether they're just intuiting the plot before they put pen to paper. But I think a plot, personally, for me anyway, a plot has to be intuited. It can't be planned or preordained.
Yes.
You have to feel the way as you go. And you can't hear your intuition if you're thinking and worrying so much about what's going to happen.
So Heather, what happened in the end with the next book?
Well, effectively, it still hasn't been written. I tried, I had a few attempts, different titles, showed them all to Chicken House. They didn't feel that they worked. I agreed for the most part. In a way, nobody can help you. That plot has to be solid in your heart for it to work.
So after this slightly fraught period, did the creativity eventually start to flow again?
Not for a very long time. In fact, I had to reach a stage where I really did give up. I was back at home with my parents, broke, without any alternative career behind me. And I said to my mum, maybe I should just stop this writing for children thing. Mm. She said, oh no, you just need a break. But I went out for a walk, and in my mind, I was letting go of it.
Right.
It was evening, and I walked up this lane and stood on the top of this small hill and had a kind of bit of an epiphany, I suppose. I just felt the largeness of the world and how many other things there might be to do out there, and just let go of this dream I'd had, and felt a great weight lift, actually. And I think that was really a new beginning.
So, listening to you, in a sense, it sounds as if part of the problem lies in our need as writers to, or perceived need to, sort of publish, 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 and that that somehow displaces the impulse to create for its own sake. And there you are, walking in Wales, realising that the world is a much bigger, richer place than the need just to get something into print.
Yes, I think that's true. My focus had become so narrow, and more importantly, my motivation had become extrinsic, as they say, based on external goals, what other people wanted,
yes.
You know, ego, really, rather than just this intrinsic motivation, which is how it started, how anyone starts writing, just from some internal desire to sort of speak to somebody who's not there, you know. Mm. And after that night, I think it might have even been the next day, I started writing poems. You know, just bad poetry, for the same reason probably that anyone starts writing poetry.
You say bad poetry, bad in what sense?
Well, there you go again. I'm judging it, aren't I? Mm. Which kills all creativity dead. But no, I wasn't taking it seriously. I was writing just to explore my thoughts, really.
Yeah.
And I wrote a poem a day for about a month. And they were just short pieces, so I didn't have to worry about plot. It was just self-expression, maybe. And I wasn't planning ahead, I wasn't thinking of the outcome, I was just capturing the moment down without any thought that I would try and get these published. And it was a massive release of creativity, now I realise. And then after that, I started going even smaller and started developing this fascination with haiku as being a distilled moment of creative awareness. And I still think haiku are absolutely fantastic, but it was letting go of any sort of plan with my work and just bringing it right back down to that moment.
Yes.
That allowed me to express that creative urge again.
So Chicken House had turned down your ideas that you'd sent them. Finding yourself without a publisher, in effect, what was the incentive then to go on writing?
Probably the same reasons that I started writing in the first place, just to connect with my own ideas, explore these worlds that I was imagining and seeing where they would take me, as a journey really, rather than as something to achieve. And from the small things really, starting small, wanting to just capture small moments.
Mm-hmm. That's like the haiku you did.
Like the haiku, and even a small scene or a small image that you think may be the seed of a story, just starting there and seeing, yes, where it might go. So it was just a more explorative journey than it had been.
And I know that you've written a bit about the specific idea of the beginner's mind, which I believe is a concept from Zen Buddhism. Could you outline for us what that term means and how it might be applied to writing?
Well, I suppose it could be translated as a free and easy wandering. And it's a characteristic that children all have. Mm. You ask them to draw a picture and they'll just sit down and draw something. They're not worried about how it's going to look. They just draw the first thing that comes to mind, perhaps. There's no judgment there. And it's a playful thing. And I think that's how I was when I first started writing. And that's what I ended up going back to after I felt that actually, maybe I wouldn't be published again, and maybe nobody was waiting now for my next book. But I still had that desire to explore. And so, without the pressure on me now, I was able to go back to that free and easy wandering.
So you started to inhabit the beginner's mind again.
I did. Yeah. I think I did.
And how does this work in practice? I suppose I'm saying, what's wrong with thinking hard, with staying with the problem until we've managed to solve it?
It's this Western idea of, if at first you don't succeed, try again, isn't it? And I question this myself. I don't know whether that's a damaging idea or not, because for me, I felt that I almost needed to try as hard as I could and then fail to know that I'd come full circle and start again.
But I don't think you're advocating that we don't bother to move forward at all.
No, we still have the things we believe in, the things we want to achieve, and there's a lot to be said for keeping moving. But it's your attitude that's all important. And I think Eastern philosophy would say that desire is one of the big problems in life. And the difficult thing is moving forward and continuing to write without that desire, that egotistical desire. I think it was Karen Blixen who recommended writing a little every day, without hope, without despair. It just implies that we keep going, we keep plodding on, and that's the discipline side of it, but we don't have that egotistical desire, that sort of irritated urge to go faster or be better. We just keep at it.
Do you think this approach applies to other disciplines as well?
I think it does, and I think it applies to life itself.
Yes.
I think it's that desire that gets us in a lot of trouble.
I'm thinking about just simple things like, when your brain is switched off, if you like, or you're relaxing, just about to drop off to sleep, and that's often when ideas will enter your mind, or you remember all sorts of things very clearly that you need to do and so on.
That's right. And with writing, that's the idea, I think. People say, if you just hold your story in your mind, don't push it, go out for a walk, and then the ideas, the solutions might come to you when you're not thinking about it, when you're actually distracted by something else.
Yeah.
And it's not just in the arts. I have a friend who's a physicist, and he would say the same. He gets ideas. Maybe he will visualise the way certain particles behave in a certain situation as he's stepping off a bus or walking to work. They come in unexpected moments, so it's not by effort of thinking that these things come to you.
So, Heather, in terms of the story of your own writing career, what's the situation now? What's happened?
Well, I feel I'm in quite a good place now. I no longer have that desperate, panic to get published again. But I have had one book accepted.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, what's
that?
Going through now. That's called The Flying Bedroom, and that will be published by a new children's publisher called Firefly. And a second book for 8 to 10-year-olds is going through editorial changes. I've done some rewriting for another Canadian publisher, Kids Can, and that one's called Magic in the City. So I'm hoping that they'll accept that one too. And ironically, they were both projects that I started when I was so determined to try and finish another book and couldn't. And they were sideline projects that I didn't take seriously and I dabbled with on the side. And yet they're the ones that have actually come good in the end.
So in fact, by not striving too hard for a publishing deal, you've achieved, if you like, the outcome that was evading you.
That's right. So now I just have to keep my head.
I think there's a lesson for us all to learn from that. Heather, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Children's writer Heather Dyer. And Heather's latest book, The Flying Bedroom, is published by Firefly. Her other books are available from the Chicken House Press.
That was Heather Dyer, recorded by Julia Copus. You can find out more about Heather on her website at www.heatherdyer.co.uk. That's Dyer spelled D-Y-E-R. And that concludes episode 15, which was produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 16, the playwright Marcy Kahan shares an audio diary for an exciting week, and a selection of RLF writers explain why they write. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.